Good morning. We're grateful to be worshiping with you all this morning. As Melissa said, we normally attend Chapel Hill Mennonite Fellowship, so it's good to get to know this sister congregation a bit, or maybe mother congregation, I don't know how. We moved to this area last fall after completing a three-year term with Mennonite Central Committee in northern Iraq.
This passage from Jeremiah, which we read this morning, leaves us hopeful because of the vision of return from exile, from displacement. But it also leaves me at least feeling a bit hopeless because of all the many people now suffering displacement and exile. Rachel is still mourning her children. Today, we want to share three stories about three different people that we met through our work whose lives embody this juxtaposition.
Most of the families who fled the Nineveh Plain overnight on August 6th, 2014, did not expect to be displaced for years. Many of them had temporarily left their homes and then returned just a few months before in June 2014, when ISIS first took control of Mosul City. But this time in August was different. As tens of thousands of displaced people became hundreds of thousands and then stretched to millions, there was no anticipated military reversal and no possibility of return for them. The front line weaved in amongst their towns and villages, nestled down, and remained unmoved for almost 2 years. This kind of displacement affects everyone in different ways. It is not just the poor, but also the wealthy, the government employees, as well as the stay-at-home moms, the college student, as well as the grandfather battling cancer. As Jeremiah said, among them, the blind and the lame, those with child and those in labor, together a great company, they shall return here. With weeping they will come, and with consolation I will lead them back. But people rarely talked about when or if they would return back, while we were in Iraq at least. You could see that the weeks had stretched to months and then to years. Churchyards and camps replaced their makeshift tarps with tents and then with prefab trailers as people settled in. Many of the displaced people we knew lived in suspended animation with little to do on a day-to-day basis and even less motivation for long-term planning in their lives. Most did not dare to hope for return, and many of those who had resources rented new houses or sought asylum as refugees in the West.
When we volunteered with Mennonite Central Committee in Iraq, we did not expect that displacement would dominate our experience, but as Caitlin has described, it did. The displacement of millions of Iraqis corresponded exactly with our time there, sort of strangely, and many Iraqis joked with us darkly about it. We arrived to Erbil in northern Iraq in July of 2014, a month after ISIS overran Mosul. And in July of 2017, we left, a few months after a coalition of Kurdish, Iraqi, U.S., and other military forces retook Mosul in a brutal siege.
Over the course of these 3 years, I worked as MCC's program coordinator for Iraq. MCC partners with Iraqi organizations, like nonprofits and churches, to provide programming in peacebuilding, education, agricultural development, and emergency assistance. While the conflict with ISIS pervaded many aspects of life, it was not and is not the only issue affecting the lives of the Iraqi people. So MCC's work tried to balance attention for the immediate crisis and other long-term underlying needs, including historic harms from previous wars and conflict, trauma training and resilience, and environmental issues.
While Caitlin worked to oversee large-scale MCC relief projects, I worked as a teacher. I was placed with several schools run by the Chaldean Catholic Church, which is an indigenous Iraqi church that goes all the way back to the first centuries of Christianity. I taught English to young men studying to be priests in a seminary. I taught history to 11th and 12th grade students at a high school, and I also did some English teaching and activities for young children at a local displaced persons center. In all our interactions with students, colleagues, partners, beneficiaries, and friends, it was obvious that Iraqis had very little reason to hope. It is easy to see the centuries of systematic harms perpetrated within and against Iraq and to despair of any justice or restoration or wholeness. And yet, in very different ways, and across their whole range of religions, backgrounds, experiences, and opportunities, Iraqis, of course, do hope. Why do they hope? And why do we hope? We want to explore this question with you all today using the stories of three friends we came to know in Erbil.
One of MCC's longest partnerships in Iraq is with Iraqi Al-Amal Association, which is an organization that focuses mostly on women's health, human rights, education, and advocacy. Al-Amal, the name of their organization, means hope in Arabic. The charismatic leader of Al-Amal is a 70-year-old woman, Hana Adwar, who is famous for berating then Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in 2011 in a live broadcast because he was dismissing protesters and arresting citizens and repressing voices of dissent. So we met this fiery 70-year-old woman, Hana, and other staff members of Al-Amal during our first few weeks in Iraq. At that time, the ISIS invasion was new, and some people were optimistic that it would be quickly pushed back and resolved. We asked the Al-Amal staff what they thought when they thought the situation in Iraq would be better. 5 years? 10 years? Maybe 50, Hanat said. Maybe our children will see it. This sobering reality weighs heavily on people who are working to improve the society of a country in crisis. Ala Ali is another staff member of Al-Amal and a graduate of Eastern Mennonite University's Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, their graduate program. Ala has worked as a researcher and a presenter to identify the underlying causes that contributed to ISIS's control in areas of Iraq like Anbar and Mosul, where they had their most control. So when we asked Ala if she has hope for Iraq, she was frank. I don't have hope for the future. I just think, what will I do tomorrow? And I do that. So in 2015, Ala, Hana, and other Al-Amal members planned a large-scale peace-building project with MCC. Al-Amal had been working on education and developing relationships with leaders within the Ministry of Education for the past decade, trying to strengthen Iraqi's institutions that had been undermined by decades of sanctions and foreign intervention. So together, the Ministry of Education and Al-Amal jointly revised the National Civics Curriculum and tested it in classrooms across the country. Some of these revisions were really simple. For example, including female as well as male names in word problems, and including names associated with minority groups instead of just the majority. So for example, sort of like using like Juan or Jamila in a US textbook, not just James. The new curriculum also included education about Iraq's history, human rights, and different religious and ethnic groups, instead of only telling the sort of dominant majority Muslim narrative. This new curriculum also used interactive activities and assignments and encouraged students to sort of think and choose critical thinking. This was a big step at a critical time. The invasion of ISIS had created the impetus for the government to show how it was combating sectarianism, and Al-Amal had been waiting for a decade for an opportunity to collaborate with the government. But this project alone would not make a big difference. As Ala cautioned me, this is one step among 1,000, but it is a step.
I first met Rami at an MCC-sponsored trauma healing workshop in the fall of 2014. Father Douglas, an Iraqi priest, wanted to train volunteers in the Christian community about trauma in order to better equip them for caring for people in their own community, especially those who had been displaced from Mosul and the Nineveh Plain. Rami was one of the youth volunteers handpicked by Father Douglas. Rami had grown up in Mosul and after high school had moved to Beji for technical school in oil engineering. Beji is a town in central Iraq and the site of Iraq's largest oil refinery. Rami had graduated in the spring of 2014 and been hired at that refinery. But just a few weeks later, ISIS swept down through Beji from Mosul on their way to Tikrit, depriving Rami of both his home in Mosul and his new job in Beji. Rami's family, along with thousands of others, left Mosul during the tumultuous days of ISIS's first takeover. fearing the warnings that Christians would be forced to pay a special tax or convert to Islam. For 2 years, they lived in Ankawa, where we lived as well, and Rami became one of my closest friends. During those 2 years, Rami was always involved in something at Mar Elia, the name of the church and IDP center where he lived. He helped organize activities for children. He taught dance classes, which were usually more like dance parties. He chaperoned children on field trips outside the church, and he was active in his youth group. In July of 2016, Rami moved with his family to Amman, Jordan, to apply for refugee status and to emigrate to the West. They're hoping for Canada, and they're still there. Rami is not optimistic, especially about his country and his place within it. He has resolved never to return to Mosul, even for a visit. He often said when we talked about this, "My country doesn't want me, so why should I stay?" But Rami is unfailingly hopeful in that he responded to all the suffering he has experienced by turning to his community and asking, "What can I do?" I attended Mass with Rami once. He went to a Syriac Orthodox church, and we usually worshipped with the Chaldean Catholics. The gospel for the day was the Good Samaritan story, and the priest used it as an example of the love of Christ, which we too ought to bear even for our enemies. "We must love ISIS," he said, "and we must love even the next ISIS." This is not, I should note, the attitude of most Iraqi Christians. Rami has hope because he has witnessed the beauty of the stories of Jesus, in which strangers bind up the wounds of enemies on the road to Jericho. He has hope and love because at the end of those stories, healing happens. And like so many other Iraqi Christians and Iraqis of all faiths in exile, Rami will now carry that hope and love that he has witnessed to a new place. But that hope is deeply wounded. It is the hope of Jeremiah 29, two chapters earlier from what we read this morning, where God says, "Seek the peace of the city where I have sent you into exile." How bitter a calling that is. It's an easy passage to celebrate if, like me, you haven't actually experienced exile. Rami has carried his love from Mosul to Erbil, from Erbil to Jordan, and will carry it with him to Canada. But he has given up hope of seeing his home in Mosul ever again. He has given up hope of returning from exile.
Our friend Barakat is a bit of a loner. A college grad with good English, he worked for various relief organizations and was adrift between his family, college classmates, and international friends. His life has been shaped by traumatic experiences. His mother died when he was a baby. His first memories are of forced displacement and relocation. His childhood was spent in the extreme hardship of the economic sanctions against Saddam's regime. One evening, he told us about his older brother, Heidel, who left home in the 1990s when Barakat was 6 years old. Heidel joined the PKK, which is a left-wing Kurdish militia, which was fighting a guerrilla campaign against the Turkish military. As a child, Barakat was always confident in his brother's return. These are his words from an email. "I was a kid, and all my family thought that he was dead and we would never see him again. But I never thought that, and I was sure that I would see him again. I dreamed so many nights that he was coming back home. One day I was sleeping, and my sister came and woke me up and said, 'Heidel is home.' That was really the best moment of my life." Heidel was home for a short time before leaving again, this time emigrating away to Germany. He kept in contact with Barakat over the years, but was estranged from the rest of his family. Because of that, Barakat was the only one who knew that Heidel returned to the region again in 2014 to join a different Kurdish armed group, the YPG, which was fighting against ISIS in Syria. Like many other fighters, Heidel quickly became disillusioned with the conflict but found himself unable to escape. Again, these are Barakat's words. The YPG took his German passport when he joined. After a few months, he tried to leave, but they didn't give him back his passport, so he tried to go back to Germany through Turkey. I don't know how he tried exactly, but it was illegal because he didn't have a passport. Since then, May 15th, 2015, I haven't spoken to him. Maybe the Turks captured him because he was with the PKK and the YPG. Maybe he went on the boat. I don't know what to say to my family, to my father. To be honest with you and myself, I don't have that hope and feeling that I had before when I was a kid that made me sure that I would see him again. Maybe it's because I'm not a kid and pure like before, but I still believe that I will see him again and talk to him about everything, just like how I told him about everything when he came back from the PKK the first time. It could be true that I can see them when I die, or maybe I never will. The people that Barakat loves most in his life, his mom and his brother, have been taken from him, and he is acutely aware of the injustice of this world. It is a world that keeps him trapped in a country without opportunities. It is a world where his older brother and thousands like him risk everything and lose everything in violent struggle and on flimsy boats. It is a world where his people do not have a country because of the politics of oil and the corruption of the powerful. Barakat doesn't have any plans for his future or dreams of what he wants to do with his life. He clings to hope because he has nothing else keeping him from despair. Why do we hope? Barakat longs for his brother's safe return, but isn't sure that it will ever happen. Meanwhile, he sees little hope for his own future. "But I still believe that I will see him again," he says. Rami has no hope of return and little hope for peace between Christians and Muslims, but he carries his love and hope for his people with him in his exile. The staff of Al-Amal Association have a large-scale vision for Iraq and the determination to make small steps, small advances, but little hope of seeing the change themselves in their lifetimes.
Why do we hope? The answer is simple for me. I hope because the Holy Spirit raised Jesus out of the tomb as she had earlier raised the exiles out of captivity in Babylon. Jeremiah's hopes from our passage today were met. He who scattered Israel did gather him like a flock. The exiles returned to Palestine for a time. But there's the rub, there's the pain in this text, at least for me. The exiles returned to Palestine, but a few centuries later the Romans brought about an even more brutal exile. And in modern times, the otherwise hopeful return of Jews to Palestine has brought about other exiles. The powerful keep displacing the weak. The many exiles of humanity have not yet come to an end. Rachel still weeps for her children. In the words of Jeremiah from earlier, "The harvest is past. The summer is ended, and still we are not saved." I do have hope, because I believe that in Christ God is, God has, God will fulfill all God's promises to free us, forgive us, and bring us back to our homes and our gardens. But we don't see it yet, and indeed it seems the height of foolishness to hope for it. All I can do is keep saying, with the author of Hebrews, "But we do see Jesus, who for a little while was made lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death." Our hope is out of our control, like Barakat's brother, or Allah's future, or Rami's lost dream of coexistence. Our hope is not our own. It is not a dream we possess, a world we can build. Our hope is rather a person who is wounded, abused, exiled. Our hope walks towards us and walks with us, inviting us into a new world already built. With our wounded hands joined with his, with Christ's, we hope to walk together back to the place we have always belonged. With weeping they shall come, and with consolations I will lead them back. Their life shall become like a watered garden, and they shall never languish again. May it be so.